Madi, I will indicate maybe via WhatsApp if you can hear me.
Yes, I can, Chair. And Chair, we are ready to start. We have 5 members, so we are ready to start, Chair.
All right. Now let's formally then open the meeting, and this is my first day at work.
Recording in progress.
I don't know if it's still necessary to wish everybody a happy new year. So mine started on a bad note. I hope things will be fine for 2023. I would like to thank all honorable members and the staff of Parliament for the messages of support, prayers, and also from the department, DTIC. I did receive also a message from the ministry, and also got a call of message of support from the deputy minister, Gina. I would like to thank you also. To thank God for giving me another chance. Giving me lots of chances. I've had COVID twice, had colon cancer, heart problems, but God has given me another chance. I thank him for that. Without any further waste of time, let's check if there are any apologies.
Okay, thank you, Chi, and welcome back to you. Chi, from the side of the apologies, we've got an apology from the Minister and Deputy Minister Majola, who are engaged in the Investor and African Continental Free Trade Agreement Business Forum engagements. From the members' side, we also have, but we do have Deputy Minister Gina with us today. I think Deputy Minister is going to be with us for the first hour, from what I've been told. From the side of the members, Chair, present today is yourself, Honourable Dango, Honourable Mashodi, Honourable Boshoff, and Honourable Lont. Ms. Matavula did indicate that she's having network problems, but she will be joining as soon as she has connection. In terms of apologies, we've got apologies from Honourable Moimang, Honourable Mamarahana, and we've got a standing apology from Honourable Lansman. In terms of my colleagues present, we've got my Pill Committee Secretary, Ms. Denny Zulu. We've got Advocate Fanda Merva, our procedural, NCOP procedural officer, Ms. Ali, and our committee assistant, Mr. Bazir. I have just admitted Ms. Matavula onto the platform as well. So she is now present.
Thank you very much. I would also like to welcome all the honourable members. I don't know if you said that the Deputy Minister is also in the meeting?
Yes, she. Deputy Minister Gina is on the platform, and our content advisor, Mr. Shuba, has also just joined us.
All right. Let me welcome the Deputy Minister and also all the honourable. I think also Honourable Ablin, I see his hand is up. Maybe you also wanted to indicate that he's present. Over to you, Honourable Lynn.
Yes, good morning, Chair. Yes, Chair, I wanted to indicate that. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you so much. Welcome.
I'm also present, Chair.
Oh, welcome, Honourable
Matthew. And welcome back, Chair. My apologies, we have a problem of load shedding in case something goes wrong.
Yes. No, thank you very much. We understand. I'm also on load shedding. I'm hotspotting. In terms of the program, we will ask the DM to make opening remarks, and then we hand over to Advocate Fanda Merva to take us through the responses to the submission made by the members of the public, the stakeholders. And then after that, we hand over to the department to also take us the responses. Welcome, Honorable DM.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Let me also express our happiness to see you here live and handsome as you are today. Thank you very much. We also thank God for giving you this chance to come and be with us. Thank you very much for that. Let me greet the members of the Portfolio Committee, greet the staff, the parliamentary staff, and also the officials that I'm coming with from the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition. Chair, we are happy really, and we are thankful for this opportunity that you are giving us to come and present our very extensive work that we have been doing with regards to these two bills that we have been seized with for quite some time now, Chairperson and Honourable Members. We are saying that the elongated time and the period that we have taken in working out the areas that were bases of this bill, we have seen it being returned from the President. It justifies from that point of view an attempt that we have made in making sure that we ensure quality outcomes, which is a product of wide consultation by the role players in the sector, and indeed that has been done. I just want to take this opportunity on behalf of the Ministry and the Department to extend our gratitude really to the public for the submissions and the submissions of comments that have been given to us in the legislative process to ensure that the law is sound and it does respond to the creation of an enabling and conducive environment for the copyright-based industry. Again, thank you very much for that. We have made sure, Chair and Honourable Members, that all the sectors affected, that includes people living with disability, the education sector, libraries, archives, museums and technology sector, the art sector, advertising, music industry, film and television industry, photographers, collecting societies, publishing industry, broadcasting industry, authors, performers have been recognized during this period. I might have left some other industries, but we really try to make sure that we cover everyone so that everyone must have a comment and something to say when it comes to these bills. These bills, Chairperson and Honourable Members, were not easy at all. They are very complex and they address several policy objectives, addressing the diverse groups of copyright-based industries. We have seen, if I can just go through the memory lane just a little bit, Chair, we can remember that on the 5th of December 2018, the National Assembly adopted the bills. On the 28th of March 2019, the NCOP adopted the bills and they were referred to the President. On the 16th of June 2020, a letter was received from the President of the Republic to the Speaker of Parliament to refer the Copyright Amendment Bill and the Performance Protection Amendment Bill 2016 to the National Assembly for consideration of the President's reservation on the basis of their constitutionality. The President raised some following constitutional reservation. First, it was the incorrect tagging, retrospective and arbitrary deprivation of property, impermissible delegation of legislative law to the minister, the issue of fair use, the copyright exception, international treaty implication. Some of these reservations that were raised by the Presidency were procedural and others substantial in nature, and they have been deliberated extensively in Parliament, and I know as we are still going to be getting to the briefing, we are going to be touching on those. Section 79, subsection 1, Honourable Chairperson, of the Constitution of South Africa, of the Republic of South Africa, requires that the President must either assent to sign the bill, or if the President has reservation about the constitutionality of the bill, he is able to refer that back to the National Assembly for reconsideration, and we have seen that happening. We have seen that the initial briefing by DTIC to the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry was in August 2020. It included a presentation on the TRIPS implementation. Part of it was delivered by the Minister of Trade, Industry and Competition. These bills were adopted by the National Assembly on the 1st of September 2022. They were referred to the NCOP for concurrence. The brief to the Select Committee on Trade, Industry and Competition, it's Trade, Industry, Economic Development, Small Business Development, Tourism, Employment and Labour took place on the 25th of October 2022. The provincial briefing to the provincial legislatures took place in most of the provinces, and as we are talking now, the department is currently participating in public hearings in some of the provinces. These provinces include Gauteng, Mpumalanga, Eastern Cape, KwaZulu-Natal, Western Cape, Limpopo and Northern Cape. Honourable members, we can see from the above that the journey that we have travelled with these two bills has been long. The departmental officials have worked on all the areas of concern and have clarified all matters raised by the sector, role players and alignment to the Marrakesh Treaty. In this regard, then, I would really love to thank these officials from the Consumer Corporate Regulation Branch and the CICP, parliamentary and provincial officials and leadership who are participating in providing support to the public hearings. The bills were recently advertised for public comment in the National Council of Provinces. The public hearings were held in the Select Committee, and we know the dates between February 21 to March 2023. Today, really, we are here to make a very brief and open presentation to you and to all the role players and those who are interested. And I will therefore share after, as per the program that we are having right now, when you call upon us as the department, I will then leave it to DDG Dr. Evelyn Masocha with his team. He's coming up with a very able team who will take through the Select Committee, through all the proceedings, through all the progress that has been made thus far, so that we can take the discussions and the input from the Select Committee. And we are always saying as the department, we always treasure and value the comments that we get from the Select Committee because they help us to do our work even better. So that is where we are today. We are here to make that presentation and we're looking forward to the inputs and the discussions that we'll be getting from the portfolio, from the Select Committee. Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson and the members of the Portfolio Committee.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Mr. Pina, for the opening remarks and also taking us through where the bills come from. I also missed out on the public hearings, but yesterday we had the management committee meeting. I've been briefed to where the process is now. I will, as I promised earlier, that we'll ask then advocate and member to take us through the responses of the constitutional legal office.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning to all the members. Good morning to my colleagues in the department as well as in Parliament. Okay, I want to, let me just see if I get the right screen to share. There we go. Okay. I don't see a green, yeah, I see a green thingy. You should be seeing my presentation on your screen now. I apologize if I'm looking away from you on the camera. It's just that my presentation is on a different screen. But I'll try and see if I can look you in the eye, so to speak, every now and then. It's something we lose from this online thing. It's got many benefits, but that eye contact is missing. But I'll try and make eye contact as much as I can. So, let me see. Let's go. I want to just start off by just drawing a clear line about the role that the Constitutional Legal Services Office plays in assisting the committee. And I know that it doesn't specifically now speak to the responses and so on, but, you know, and in fact, you've now just heard, this bill has come a very long, long way. You know, we started with this in 2017 already. And I think some of the public have come to know my name, and there has been some expectations put forward to the committee on what it is that I should be doing. And I only have a mandate that is limited, so I just want to explain that very quickly to members. So when, I'm sorry, there seems to be, oh, I now went ahead, I'm sorry. So from our office's side, we advise on what is before the committee. So in other words, whatever the policy position is that is proposed in the bill, that is what we advise on. We are not going to advise the committee on whether this policy direction or something else that is proposed by the public would be the best solution to address the mischief that these bills are trying to address, simply because that is not where we are experts. Our expertise lies in constitutionality, in legal questions, in drafting questions, interpretation, and those are the things that we will be advising the committee on. So for instance, some of the things that were referred and then the legal advisor of parliament was requested to address those are technical matters. They deal with policy, and therefore I cannot speak to that. For instance, whether the definition of audiovisual work should include cinematograph film. I cannot address that. That is something the department will address. What I can assure the committee and what I can assure, because I know the public is also following and presenters and people who made submission, because there's a lot of interest in this bill. What I can assure the committee and those who are listening is that all submissions have been considered by myself as well, but also by our committee support staff. I have specifically looked at legal questions. But where there was a policy question that did not make sense to me, or where I was concerned about what the correct answer might be and whether the bill in fact reads the way the department wants it to read, I did bring that to the attention of the department. I have also been further in discussions with them. We've sorted those issues out, and they have addressed the ones that are pertinent in their presentation as well. So everything is being addressed, but when I present, I'm going to talk to fair use, for instance. Doesn't mean that I'm an advocate for fair use. It simply means that that is what is in the bill before the committee. So I also just want to, because of this long history of the bill, I just also want to speak a bit about the redrafting, that process, because there were a lot of criticism given to the committee on the bill's process. But I want to assure this committee that between the fifth parliament and the sixth parliament and now in this committee, these bills, in fact, both of them, have received a lot of attention. There were serious concerns about the terminology used, and the bills were actually redrafted. There was a whole team that consisted of parliamentary staff, department staff, and experts. There were a further panel of experts that also made some inputs, and all of the inputs were considered. The other thing that I also just want to speak to, when we redrafted, and I think the bill is introduced also mentioned it, if I remember correctly, but more important is the concern about the Intellectual Property Laws Amendment Act being referenced in this bill. Now, the problem is that the Intellectual Property Laws Amendment Act, even though it's not operational yet, is on the statute book. So, for instance, I'll just give one example of how ignoring the Intellectual Property Laws Amendment Act in our bills will have a negative effect. The IP Laws Amendment Act inserts sections 28A to 28N. Our bill, the Copyright Amendment Bill, then inserts sections 28O to S. In other words, it follows on where the IP Laws Amendment Act stops. Now, clause 29 of our bill indicates that 28P and 28S, which is inserted by our Copyright Amendment Bill, constitute defenses to an offence, a criminal offence. So if we ignore the IP Laws Amendment Act and we start with 28A and 28B, which is now inserted by the IP Laws Amendment Act, and the IP Laws Amendment Act comes into operation a year from now, then our Act, the Copyright Act as amended, will have two 28A sections And the question would then be, which one of these is the defense? So we cannot ignore something that is on the statute book. Even if that act becomes repealed at some point in time, we will still consider those sections created by that act as relevant to our processes. So it is unfortunate. I understand that people feel uncomfortable and did not like the IP Laws Amendment Act, especially the members of the public who were concerned about including it. But unfortunately, it is on our statute book. It is unfortunate that it is not yet operational and it creates this uncertainty. But that is unfortunately what we need to do when we draft. We must take into account every single act that is on the statute book, whether operational or not. So the next aspect that I want to talk about is the Section 79(1) process. And there were concerns raised in the NCOP referring to the process in the National Assembly, indicating that it was unfair how the National Assembly limited itself to certain aspects in the consideration of the bills. The problem is that the National Assembly was bound by the joint rules, Part 8 of the joint rules, which deals with the process to reconsider bills. In other words, bills that were referred back by the President in terms of Section 79(1) of the Constitution. So the rules indicate that the committee must consider and confine itself to the President's reservations. So where there were submissions on other sections, the committee was advised to not consider those, because to consider those would have meant that the legislative process was flawed, because the portfolio committee would not have complied with the joint rules of Parliament. So the rules are there and we must comply with them. The process in the NCOP is very different. And the reason for that is because one of the reservations was the classification of the bill. In other words, what was the process that the bill must follow through Parliament? And the portfolio committee decided that it will err on the side of caution, because the court cases indicate to us that where Parliament classifies a bill as a Section 76, but it should have been a Section 75, it is unlikely that the court will find the process flawed. So it is almost better to err on the side of caution when is a bit of a conflict or an uncertainty. So that is then what happened. The bills were reclassified as Section 76. So the whole process in the National Council of Provinces changed, which means that it must start from scratch, because it's a whole different process, very, very different process. And that is why in the National Council of Provinces, the whole bill, or both bills, in fact, the whole part of the bill is open and the committee can consider any aspect on the bills. There were also some concerns raised about consultation, but I can confirm from my side at least that what I know about is I have seen summaries from the department on all submissions. I have seen summaries from the support staff on all submissions. I have seen all submissions. So from my side, I can confirm to this committee, to the members, that all submissions have been considered. What we need to, however, keep in mind is that considering a submission and accepting what is proposed in that submission are two very different things. It is for this committee, of course, to consider very carefully every single submission, every proposal that is made, to consider the responses to those proposals. There might be a proposal that has a lot of value and then the responses will confirm that, or there might be something where there is a difference of opinion on what is the best direction to go. There might be a legal view which I could agree with or which I disagree with. And the committee must then consider both sides and decide which seem to them to be the most supported, the most likely to be found, if it's a legal question, by a court, the most likely to succeed if it is a policy question, and then make a decision from there. But it doesn't mean that if a proposal in a submission is not accepted, that the submission was in fact not considered. That is simply not the same thing. The next aspect that I want to talk to, now I'm getting to the legal stuff. So the next thing I want to talk to is constitutionality. There were a lot of concerns about the exceptions in the Copyright Amendment Bill constituting arbitrary deprivation. So I want you to just talk about arbitrary deprivation, because I have found over the years when people feel don't agree with the content of a bill, they tend to say, oh, but this is arbitrary deprivation. Oh, but this is unconstitutional. But we need to look at what that actually means. We can't just make these statements. And it might be that a different lawyer comes to a different conclusion. But I will give to this committee what I have considered, how I've come to my conclusion, and then you can decide whether what I've argued before you now is sufficiently supported to convince you. So, first of all, it's very important that we keep in mind that Section 25 of the Constitution does not create a right to property. Our Constitution does not have a right to property. We've got a right to equality, we've got a right to education, we do not have a right to property. What we do have is a right to not be arbitrarily deprived of our property. And it is very important to make that distinction, because it even goes so far, our courts have even indicated that if the deprivation is not arbitrary, then Section 36, which determines the limitations and the justification for limitations of the rights in the Bill of Rights, does not even come into play. It is only when deprivation is arbitrary that we then look at whether that arbitrary deprivation is done in terms of Section 36. So it's a very important distinction to make. So when we look at arbitrary deprivation, that the Constitution gives two requirements, law of general application, and it may not be arbitrary. Now, these laws are laws of general application that apply nationally to everybody, so they're definitely laws of general application. The question then is, if we accept that copyright is in fact property, is it then arbitrary deprivation? So we need to keep in mind that copyright as such has always had exceptions. The Act provides, and I think one of the presenters mentioned, it's called the Copyright Act, not the Exceptions to Copyright Act. Well, yes, there's other drafting conventions that play there as well, why we call it copyright and not exception. But the Copyright Act provides not only for when copyright vests and what you can do with your copyright, but it has always provided for exceptions and limits to your copyright, because that is what a copyright is. A right does not only give you, a right is not unlimited unless it says it is unlimited. A right almost always, I mean, even our Bill of Rights has limitations, has some limitations, and that forms part of the right. And that is what our Copyright Act has been dealing with. So if we look at copyright without any limits, so let's say it is unlimited, like I just said, then what we have is that copyright will affect and will in fact limit other positive rights that are contained in our Constitution, the right to equality, to human dignity, to freedom of expression, to a cultural life, and to education. And on these specific rights, I'll speak a bit more when I get to the Blind SA case, because the court highlighted how copyright affects those rights so beautifully. But I will get there when I get there. The purpose of these bills, in other words, is in fact to balance. We want to balance the copyright, but we also want to balance other rights. The rights of a user, where it comes to the equality, dignity, freedom of expression, cultural life, education, etc. So the other purpose of the bills is to align copyright with your digital era and to promote multilateral development. So when we look at how all of these things work, when we look at arbitrary deprivation, before I get to that, I just first want to show. So the purpose of the Act, I've now given you the two purposes of the bill, the balance and to bring it into line with technical development. If we look at international developments in copyright, we will see that Canada actually has a fair dealing not fair use. But Canada was talking about a balance being necessary between the rights of users and copyright holders. There must be a proper balance. And the court actually said user rights are not just loopholes. In other words, it is not just something that, you get away with something. It is an actual right because it affects certain human rights. So, well, in fact, the human rights affecting is now I'm combining two cases, but that is how I see it when I look at all the cases. When we look at WIPO, they've got a document speaking specifically to exceptions and limitations, and they also stress the appropriate balance between the interests of rights holders and the users of protected works. There was also a Professor Cruz who did a specific analysis of exceptions and limitations. And in fact, on my slide presentation that was circulated to members, in the notes section, I did put links to all of these cases and documents if members want to have a further look at that. So Prof. Cruz came to a conclusion that there is in fact less than a third of countries have exceptions for libraries, for research, and especially in respect of technological advances, exceptions that make provision for technological advances. And his finding was that there's an urgent need to update exceptions for the digital age in order not to undermine efforts to realize the objectives. And then very interestingly, the findings indicated that these kind of exceptions are more common in rich countries. They are much better prepared for the technological age. And it seems that your poorer countries are lagging behind. And for instance, the European Union and your developed group was always first or second when it came to preparedness. So this is something that is in the developed world. And to some extent, it sometimes felt that it's developed world examples that were put to this committee in opposition of what these bills are trying to do. And I think that proposal from those findings from WIPO is something to keep in mind, because these two bills are trying to bring a balance, and especially in respect of those constitutional rights, which is very important from my perspective, because that affects the legal issues behind this bill. When we look at arbitrary deprivation, what is that? I'm finally getting there. And I've already said that the test is narrower than Section 36, because that only comes into play if there is an arbitrary deprivation. So when is there a sufficient reason? That is what is necessary, a sufficient reason. If you don't have sufficient reason, it's arbitrary. So what is sufficient reason? And the courts have given us some guidance. I'm specifically here referring to the First National Bank versus West Bank, trading as a West Bank case versus Minister of Finance, where the court indicated that you must look at the purpose of the law. So we already looked at the purpose of the law, balance and the technological age, preparing us for that. The purpose of deprivation is the persons affected, the nature of the property, and the extent of the deprivation. Looking on the nature of the property, the court also said if the property in question is land or a corporeal movable, then there should be a more compelling purpose. Now, intellectual property, and it hasn't been decidedly stated by our courts that it is property, but we expect that it would be accepted as property. But there would be less compelling reasons necessary for a non-corporeal property, is what the court then indicated. So I want to specifically, these factors that I've now mentioned, I want to go a bit further onto that to look at the extent of the deprivation. Now, not only do we provide in the bills four factors for the fair use aspect, but each of the specific exceptions has their own specific guidelines, parameters that must be complied with. So the extent of deprivation is not unlimited. It is within very clear delineated areas, parameters. And on my slides, I just give a couple of examples, but I'm not going to go through them specifically. Most of these include that it must be non-commercial, and that you may not exceed the extent justified by the purpose. So just for to save time, I'm not going to go to read through them. They are in the bill. So the question then is there sufficient reason? And our office would submit that there is, in fact, sufficient reason. Your evaluation would likely be more to the rational relationship between the means and ends than towards proportionality. In other words, that Section 36 argument. However, three-step, and I'll come to the three-step test. If we look at the three-step test, there is, in fact, some proportionality in there. And my argument would be that our bills comply with the three-step test. So even if found to be arbitrary deprivation, I would argue that Section 36 would be complied with as well. But in my view, it is not arbitrary deprivation, the exceptions and limitations. If we look at the purpose of the law, I've indicated already, balanced, technological, that's a very valid reason to make these amendments. The nature of the property, intellectual property is not land, so the incorporeal, less compelling reasons would be sufficient. The extent, it's not the extent of the deprivation, there are limits. It is not unlimited. So the other aspect that could render actually the whole bill unconstitutional is that of procedural fairness. And that would also be taken into account when it comes to a test for arbitrary deprivation. But I think I've stated already, you know, these bills come from 2017. There was a lot of work done on them. It was not just a committee, none of the committees can be accused of just railroading these bills through. A lot of experts were consulted. A number of consultations in the public were made. All submissions were considered. The classification has now been changed. So even that process cannot be held against these bills. I cannot see these bills being found to not pass constitutional muster procedurally. We have really gone the extra mile. Both committees in both houses, in both parliaments, have gone the extra mile on this. The other constitutional issue that was raised is that, I call it the Section 22 top, because it deals with trade, you have the right to choose your trade, occupation or profession. Now, the problem is that if legislation, we may make legislation to regulate a trade or occupational profession. So, for instance, like we've got the legislation regulating medical professionals, so we're regulating lawyers, et cetera, et cetera. So that is the kind of legislation foreseen by Section 22. But now, what the courts have found in the South African Diamond Producers Organization case is that when the legislation actually goes so far as to make it impossible for a person to enter into a professional occupation or trade, then that would be against Section 22. So there must be an effective limit or an effective bar. For instance, what I could give as a quick example would be if legislation were to say that due to safety measures, all females that are shorter than 1.5 meters may not become an engineer working with a certain machine. That would definitely be an entry. I would not be able, I'm shorter than 1.5, I will not be able to enter into that profession. That would be an effective bar to me. So you will then have to look at Section 36, whether there's a reasonable proportionality, et cetera, et cetera. Now, when we look at these bills, there is no effective bar. What it does is to correct the balance that is there. Because, and the other thing that we need to keep in mind is that most of the presenters spoke from the point of view of the producers, the big houses, the companies, and how having this balance corrected towards your author, in other words, your actors, your performers, your writers, your songwriters, they are all authors as per the Copyright Act. To have this balance brought back is affecting these companies because, you know, they will make less profit because they need to be more profit sharing with these with the author. But what we didn't hear a lot of, and which is as valid, is that the wording of the Act as it currently stands is in fact an effective barrier to some authors. There were one or two that came to present in this committee. There were also one or two that came to present in other committees about the dire circumstances that makes it impossible for them to actually continue being an author as envisaged by the Act. So it's very necessary that we look at both sides, because both sides have the right to Section 22. And we must look at whether these bills create an effective barrier. And in our office's view, the bills, in fact, correct a current situation where there is an effective barrier to authors to do the necessary work. The international treaties, I'm not going to say too much about this. I think the department will speak to this a lot. But I do just want to quickly raise with the committee that, in fact, there was a lot of consultation about around the treaties. The bills are adopting actually many clauses from the Electronic Information for Libraries Model Law, from the Marrakesh Treaty, and also from other copyright regimes that are following these treaties. And there were lots of consultations held, and there was also a technical panel that advised on these treaties, and all of these views were in fact considered. Now, another thing that I just want to point out when it comes to international treaties, none of the treaties mentioned are currently binding on South Africa. We want them to be binding. And so that is why these bills are before the committee. They are giving effect to these treaties. But if, and I'm not saying that we are against any treaty, but any aspect that is not compliant is not going to render the bill unconstitutional. It is something that will have to be dealt with in respect of what exceptions that treaty allows, because treaties do not form part of our constitution. Their obligation must be considered when we consider the Bill of Rights, and that is the only effect for these treaties in respect of our constitution. So in effect, the advice that I was given to the committee before was actually that the treaties should not be part of the Section 79 referral. But the portfolio committee decided to err on the side of caution rather. But we need to also keep in mind, so first of all, it's not a constitutional issue. Do we comply? Well, the department will advise further, but that has so far what I could see from the treaties that I've compared with clauses in the bill. And we must also keep in mind what WIPO itself is saying on limitations and exceptions. They indicate that it will vary from country to country because of social, economic, and historical conditions. And in fact, international treaties acknowledge this diversity by providing general conditions for the application of limitations and exceptions. And they leave national legislatures to decide if a particular limitation or exception is to be applied, and if it is the case, to determine the exact scope. Now, I read that, and I don't like reading a presentation, but I read that because that was very important. The legislature of a country can decide the exact scope of a limitation that is allowed in terms of treaties. I also quickly want to talk about the three-step test, because there was a lot of concern about that, not the bills not complying with that. This is something that I consider from a legal point of view, so not an international treaty point of view. I consider it from a legal point of view. What the three-step test says is that any exceptional limitation must be confined to certain special cases, must not be in conflict with the normal exploitation of the copyright work, and must not unreasonably prejudice the legitimate interests of the rights holder or the author. I then found a number of entries on the internet, international comparisons, because we don't have any court case that has considered the three-step test in respect of intellectual property law. So I had to go globally. The Max Planck Institute indicated that the three steps must be considered as a whole. You can't just break them up separately. They're one joint requirement. Furthermore, they don't require you to do a narrow interpretation. You must look at the objectives and the purposes of your exception and your limitation. And then the Max Planck Institute specifically indicated that fair use would be a specific instance for purposes of the three-step test, because they, what they argued was that fair use is not more or less foreseeable than fair dealing. So they indicated further that the test should be interpreted in a way that respects the legitimate interest of third parties. So the other thing about that I want to specifically refer, that I found rather, was the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties. Now, although we are not a signatory to this, this has been used by our courts, in fact, to interpret treaties. So I thought that we could definitely go there. Now, the USA already applied fair use a long time ago. And what the Vienna Convention indicates is that it is necessary to consider the actions of member states. So in other words, if a treaty reads A, but member states act B, then B actually becomes how the treaty should be interpreted. So the USA was already using fair use when it joined. A number of other signatories after joining Bern changed to fair use. And in fact, the Australian Law Reform Commission found that looking at the history of the test itself, the three-step test, the words of the test, looking at how member countries acted, they are of the view that fair use would, in fact, comply with the three-step test. So in our office's proposal would be that, in fact, they do comply. There was also some indication of some proposal to include the actual wording of the three-step test in the bills. On this slide, I am making a quick sort of a comparison between fair use, fair practice, and a three-step test. Now, basically, most authors that I could find, in fact, all authors that I could find, indicated that the three-step test is not intended to be included in legislation. It is intended to provide a guide. So as the Max Planck Institute indicated, you look at them globally. So they give you a guidance. And you look at the words of your law and whether they fall within that guidance. But if you look at the factors, they are very much aligned. Some duplicate in one or the other, but you can find them to be aligned. So it is just important that we capture the intention. So in fact, in the portfolio committee, we did add the wording of the three-step test in one or two exceptions, and it just became impossible. That exception became null and void. It would not have been something that can, in fact, be implemented, because you will have your normal exceptions plus certain other exceptions, and it just did not make sense. So from our office, we would not recommend that the wording of the three-step test is specifically included in the bills. Our argument is that the exceptions as they are currently worded do comply with what the three-step test envisage. Now I get to the specific issues in the bill. The first one relates to definitions. And yeah, I think I'll go quite fast because it's more interpretation concerns. I don't think they need a lot of explanation. Authorized entities or from proposals to specifically mention the spheres of government. It's not necessary. Government includes all spheres. There were also some requests to specifically define certain terms. But the reason for definitions in a bill is that the words in that definition section are either unclear generally, may have more than one meaning, or are in fact being extended or limited to its normal meaning. So, for instance, when we define board, and I'm sure the committee members would have seen the definition of board quite often in legislation. Now, board is the body that oversees a company. We all know that. But then we define it in an act to say board means the board established by Section 3. So when we talk about board in this act, we specifically mean the water board or the electricity board, or whatever board it is in Section 3, and not any other board. So we limited the meaning of board. And that is all that we use definitions for. If a word has the meaning that it has in the dictionary, we need not define it in the bill. I mean, otherwise, our definition sections would become pages and pages and pages, and actually would just add to interpretation challenges. Broadcast I working through the department's presentation quickly, I noted they were recommending that broadcast, the definition for broadcast, if I understand them correctly, but they will speak to it a bit more, should be removed from the bills. The definition for broadcast has been very contentious. And the problem is that the Department of Communications is busy developing a definition for broadcast that would comply with current technology, but also as technology grows. And that has been in the making, I think, since the start of this bill. So and I don't think it's an easy task. So to ask it from this committee to agree on a definition of broadcast is actually a very impossible task. So what was decided in the portfolio committee was just a basic definition for broadcast, but I understand that the department is saying, let's go back to the Act and we wait for the Department of Communication, which is also in order. I can't see a problem with that. The definition for performer, my major issue was the word extras. But now, an extra is not a performer. It's an extra. It's a very, if you look at the industry, no one in the industry will tell you that an extra is a performer. That is simply not how it is. And also, the bill's definition is exactly the same as the Beijing Treaty, which speaks to, if you compare the two, like I've got here on the slide, you'll see that it's exactly the same. The one is just singular because we draft in the singular and not plural. That's really the only difference. Technological protection measure, I'm not going to say too much because there's a lot that can be said about technological protection measure. But in the portfolio committee, there was a request for making it more strict, making technological protection measure more strict. The problem with that is that technological protection measures in especially developed countries has a much easier, it's much easier to obtain the permission from your big company to circumvent the technological protection measure. But if you're in Africa, and in fact, I found a couple of articles on this that was quite concerning. Technological protection measure. There was actually one instance during COVID that I came across with the lockdowns where a hospital could not, their engineering staff, their medical engineers, could not adjust the respirators because of a technological protection measure. The more well-known example is of a person who needs to just quickly fix his tractor, busy plowing, something happened in the engine, but he can't because he can't circumvent the technological protection measure. So he has to take that tractor into John Deere, and John Deere will then fix it there. So the big problem, and the article that I came across that I thought was very informative about how the challenges that the USA is facing, they're a developed country, the challenges that they are facing because of a strict technological protection measure and circumvention device definition in their law is that they don't have a link between the actual infringement of that technological protection measure and the use. So, And if you simply say you may not circumvent, you're taking that link away. And the challenge of that is that the impact of taking that link away is that we lose the freedom to arrange our own conduct to our benefit. In other words, I have purchased a CD. I want to put it on my laptop, but it's actually a very bad example. I apologize, but let me continue with it. But there is something on that CD that prevents me from putting it onto my laptop. I can't circumvent it, but it's my CD, and I don't have a CD player at home. I only have my laptop. That's how I play all my CDs, but it's my product. I bought it legally, but I can't do anything about it. And that is what that first factor talks about. We lose the freedom to arrange our conduct to our own benefit. We must play, we must use the product, we must use that CD the way the CD maker intended me to use it, i.e. on a CD player. The second thing that we lose is the freedom of third parties to offer accessories, consumable service and repairs for the products that we own. The tractor example. The farmer can't just contact the mechanic that he knows that lives next door and say, quickly come and check my tractor for me. He must take the tractor to John Deere. So you lose that freedom as well. And then the third one is actually a security risk because you lose the freedom to uncover and publicize defects in products. So this is actually a big challenge that we need to look at. So from our side, our office would not recommend that technological protection measure or circumvention advice be amended at all. I'm sorry, I'll go a bit faster. I see I'm taking a bit long with my presentation. Visual artistic work, this is again just an interpretation matter. They say all visual work, all artistic works are visual. This is more of a policy concern, but like I say, with the dictionary definition, if that is what it means, we would have kept that, but we are going a bit broader. Adding definitions, I've already spoken to that. The fact that the performance protection refers to the Copyright Act, these acts work together. They really work together. The one depends on, or the performance depends on copyright in more than one way. And it is, in that instance, easier to refer to the Copyright Act for a definition, because if you amend that definition in future, you don't have to amend both acts. You just amend the one. The other one was about producer and the fact that it should indicate there's no provision for corporate entities. Just to say in South African law, the word person, in fact, includes corporates. So person is natural and juristic persons. I've noticed that the department is also proposing a review of dramatic person, that definition, but I think they will speak to that. They will be able to do so much better. Sections 5.2 and 21.2, this deals with local organizations. I'm not going to say too much about it because the department has a very good presentation on that. But just to indicate that when it comes to including local organizations in Sections 5 and Sections 21, it is not by itself arbitrary. There is a rationale. And there is a rationale that the department will speak to a bit more. I think let me rather leave it there. Retrospective application of clauses 5, 7, and 9, there was a request to bring retrospectivity back. The problem is, although there is a reason to go retrospective, so what this dealt with was that going forward, authors will, even if an author sells their rights in a book or a music work or whatever, there will be continuous royalties being paid to them. And royalty is specifically defined in these sections. That means something different from other applications of the word royalty. The problem, however, is that it becomes arbitrary deprivation because we don't know the extent of this retrospective action. We don't know who it will affect. At this point in time, it will affect anyone. So it will affect people who were historically disadvantaged. It will also affect people, it also affects people who were not historically disadvantaged, who were able to argue and negotiate for a proper contract. So there's the one thing. What would happen if the copyright in the work was sold and that person who bought it sold it on to a third party at a very reasonable price? The third party paid a good sum for it. It's that this middleman who exploited the author. What do we do in those circumstances? So it's just too much uncertainty, and uncertainty in law is not constitutional. It's against the rule of law, and that is why we recommended that rather be taken out of the bill. The royalties I just spoke to say that it's specifically defined in these clauses, and it means something different. Now, there was an argument that author is not, it's not the correct term, but that is not the situation. Section 6A, 7A makes provision for two scenarios. So you have a copyright author, owner who is not the author that is exploiting the work. So copyright owner bought it and is exploiting the work. You have the author who is the copyright owner, hasn't sold it yet, but authorizes a third party, maybe a license, to do something. And that is then what this section deals with. And you need to make provision for both scenarios. So there is an amendment that I suggest that could perhaps make it a bit more clear. I'm not going to go into the amendment as much. That is simply what it says. It makes it more clear that there might be a situation where your copyright owner is not the author and where the author is, in fact, the copyright owner. I also, I believe it was circulated to members, the list of the amendments that is being proposed from our office. In respect of Clause 7, this deals with national treatment, and I saw that the department has a very good slide on this, or speaking to this So I won't say too much on this, except to say that the concerns that were raised, I did check that, but it seems to me that there is in fact a reciprocal duty provided by the reference to Section 37. So that was the one concern. And the other concern was that it was superfluous because there's already provision for visual artistic works. But if you look at the sections that are affected, you'll see that visual artistic works are limited, they're grouped together. And that is why there would be the additional reference. Fair use, I've already started talking about this. The department is proposing a change to the fourth factor in Section 12A, and I'll let them speak to that a bit more. On my last slide, I make a comparison with the USA wording, and I think then that could help members as well when considering the proposal that the department will be making here. There was which model to use, like I said, is a policy matter, but there was indication that this is something that is not desirable. This way we have Section 12A and then a specific list of exceptions. But all that this is that there are specific exceptions that we want to provide for. These exceptions, in fact, most of them address a specific constitutional right, education, the rights of persons with disabilities. And what we then have is a general 12A, which gives you the factors for matters that we have not foreseen, which is in fact a very responsible way of drafting legislation. Because, I mean, look at these bills. They have been before Parliament for 6 years. If that is how long it takes to amend an act, we need to be cognizant of what the future might bring and that we don't know everything. The other thing that I noticed from the department is that in respect of Section 12C, they are proposing to remove adaptation. I don't have a legal concern with that, and I believe the department will speak to that a bit more in detail. And this is where Blind SA comes. So here I will spend a bit of time, but also not too much because I see that I'm taking very long. Now, first of all, the one concern about Section 19D is that it goes much further than the Marrakesh Treaty. It provides for all work, provides for all types of disability, whereas Marrakesh focuses on persons with a visual disability. And if we look at the Marrakesh Treaty, it clearly indicates that a country may, in fact, make provision for other copyright limitations and exceptions for the benefit of beneficiary persons, which are persons with a disability, than what is provided by the treaty. So we can go broader. It also says that there is no prejudice to other limitations and exceptions provided for persons with a disability. The third thing that we need to keep in mind is that our constitution compels us to consider equality. And if we give certain rights to persons with a visual disability, and tomorrow there is technology that might help a person with a hearing problem or a person with a mental health problem, why would we then have to retake the act to the court to fight again for the same right as the court has now acknowledged clearly in the Blind SA matter does exist? It just does not make sense. We need to comply with our constitution and we need to provide for all forms of disability. And the same aspect in respect of all works, we cannot just limit it to one aspect. And in fact, there was a good example given by Blind SA in that you can't just limit it to a literary work, because if you look at sheet music, what is sheet music? Is it a literary work? Or is it, because it could be in a book, it could be in a book form, or is it a musical work? Because if you look at the definition of musical work, it could be a work consisting of music, exclusive of words or actions. So you might have a situation where a blind musician is limited to access sheet music because there's an argument that it's a musical work, which is not covered by 19D. And these are the kind of things, and taking into account our constitution, that are simply unnecessary. When we look at, and I'll get to that as well, because I think that might be one of the concerns, was the unfair application of Section 19D. But we'll get there, and I'll show to members that there's no way that Section 19D can be used unfairly. It just cannot be. So the Blind SA case specifically indicated that the Act unjustifiably limits the rights of persons with visual and print disabilities. And the Constitutional Court made it very clear, and I think I have a little bit of, yes, I set it out in the notes page, so I won't go into too much detail, but it might be worth a read. Infringing the rights to equality, human dignity, freedom of expression, cultural life, and there's also no justification that can be given for the limit in respect of the right to education. And the court then considered 19D, but because the facts before the court was on visual impairment, the court could not use the words of Section 19D. So some of the presenters who indicated that Section 19D was found to be not fit for purpose only gave half the picture. 19D was not fit for purpose for the judgment in Blind SA because a court cannot go broader than the facts before it, which is a pity, but that is unfortunately how courts work. They can only make an order on the facts before it. So because 19D includes other works, includes other disability forms, forms of disability, the court could not use 19D. It did not say that 19D was not a suitable section for the bill. It is simply not suitable for its judgment, and that's a very different aspect. So the next couple of slides deal with the proposed changes. I'm again not going to make too much, go into too much detail into this. The wording is there, and it is simply to provide clarity and make sure that we don't have a problem between how the bill reads and how the Marrakesh Treaty reads, that sufficient provision is made. So for instance, there was, in respect of authorized entity, now an authorized entity is someone who may make an accessible format copy for a person with a disability. And just to make sure that it could be any entity, not just a government institution or non-profit organization, but very importantly, that this is done on a non-profit basis. So that is actually proposed to be put into the actual wording. Then if we go to the section itself, the first concern there in subsection 1 was that that authorized entity seems to be something that should be prescribed, but that is simply I drafted that incorrectly. Let me take that responsibility. It was never intended for authorized entity to be prescribed. Otherwise, we would not have defined it. So it is just to move it to the front so it is very clear that there's no regulations applying to authorized entity. Then there was also a concern that you can't have a new accessible copy made every time. You must be able to make a copy from a copy if you are an authorized entity and you're doing this, of course, for a person with a disability. So that is just a proposal to have a new subsection 3, which is based on the court's read in fact. That makes it clear that if you have a copy of the work, you can make an accessible format copy of that copy. And the same applies to 19D3. And then there's also something in respect of 28P. This deals with circumvention of a technological protection measure. And in fact, I looked at 28P2 and I realized that when we added service to the definition, that wasn't there from the start. So then at some point towards the last of the amendments that were made to the bill, we added service to technological protection measure circumvention device. And suddenly 28P2 no longer made sense, because when we get to 28P1, it says that you can, if you're doing this for a lawful reason, you can in fact circumvent the technological protection measure or ask someone to do it for you. Then 2 comes and says, if you can't do it, you need to approach the owner. But I'm already being able to ask someone else to do it for me. Why would I approach the owner? So that's when I realized, when we added service, the request to the owner actually becomes null and void. So the proposal would be to delete that, and then a consequential amendment to the subsection below to just not refer to that specific section that we've now deleted. The next slide just gives a full overview of all the amendments that I'm proposing. Members can make a note of it as slide 32, but I've also, like I said, I did circulate a list of all the amendments that I'm proposing. The remainder are actually just I don't think there's a significant proposal further. Clause 24, there was just a concern that when we look at what the remainder of the rights are, it's not clear who it goes to. So there's just a proposal how we can word it to make clear that the remainder of the rights, in fact, vest in the author. But it kind of speaks for itself. But you know, laws must be drafted as clear as possible. So that would be something. The 25-year reversion right, deprivation of property, well, it will only apply prospective. It won't apply backwards. So in other words, if I now enter into a contract, I will know that after 25 years, this thing that I'm buying will revert back to the author. So those are the terms of my contract. That's simply how that trade will work. We are regulating a trade going forward. So there's no deprivation of property at all. Offences. There was a concern that the authority of the owner is necessary. Now, when it comes to an offence, I agree that that's a concern. Because if it was a licensee that gave me the authority, then I would have committed an offence if it was required. The owner themselves must have given it. But I've worked through all the offences, and there's nothing that requires the owner's specific permission. And on top of that, it requires knowledge. So in other words, if I am of the view that the licensee was duly authorised to do this, and I then proceed to use the product in the way that I want, I can say, but I did not know that the owner didn't give it. And it will then not constitute a criminal offence. That would be a sufficient defect. So I don't think that there's a problem with permission given by the owner itself. There was a proposal to adding circumstances, but circumstances just introduce vagueness. And with it, when it comes to offences, we need to be very clear. You're playing with people's lives, and I think we need to be very clear when it comes to an offence. There was also a concern about strict liability. Like I said, no, knowledge is absolutely a requirement. Strict liability is where I commit an offence even not knowing it. So I'm walking and I don't even know, I'm not looking where I'm walking because I'm deep in thought. I go through a gate that actually said no entry and I'm caught inside. I will be liable even though I didn't realise that I was walking through the gate. That's strict liability. That is not the case in our offences. Knowledge is a requirement in every system, in every instance. There was one thing perhaps that I could explain in how we draft is Section 25, 27(5)(c) is drafted as something we call a sandwich clause. So that means your introductory sentence, the top one, and the closing sentence, the bottom one, applies to everything in between. So in respect of both paragraphs A and B, those will only be an offence if there isn't a defence in terms of Section 28S and the person knew that the act was infringing on copyright. Commercial activities, whether that should be an offence or not, the department will speak to that. Whether it should be an offence or rather a civil remedy, the department will also speak to that. There is something between subsection 5B, 2 and 3. It makes it seem as if there is something that can be done without knowledge, and that should not be the case. So the proposal is that subparagraphs 2 and 3 be combined to make it very clear that the service is rendered and you know, not just rendering the service in itself. Section 28P, there was a concern again about this one is actually quite an interesting one. What the clause indicates is just exceptions. It doesn't speak to it doesn't speak to limitations at all. And yes, that is a problem because not all exceptions are limitations or not all limitations are exceptions. So there's definitely a requirement for that to be clarified. So we would recommend that it is by law, including an exception, so that limitations are in fact also provided for. There was a concern that the tribunal may not call witnesses, but there's no way the court will interpret that section in a way that leads to an absurdity. You know, the same with in fact, I think I skipped over that now, but when it comes to Section 19D with accessible format copies, a court is not going to reach an absurd situation where someone who can see is now repairing a wheelchair and then somehow the accessible format copy now applies to the person who can see. That is simply an absurd interpretation. The person who can see must look at the specifications that have been issued formally or is a lawful copy. In repairing the wheelchair for the person who is a person with a disability, that section simply doesn't come into play. So we must always keep in mind the purpose of a section. A court is not going to make an absurd interpretation. When it comes to the functions of the tribunal, if the tribunal sections indicate that witnesses will be questioned, of course witnesses must be allowed. How can a witness not be allowed before the tribunal? It is sometimes not necessary to spell everything out in the act. There was also a very big concern about compulsory contract terms. Now, first of all, the way it is worded is that it will be terms that must be included. So what it intends is protection, and that's it. It's just protection that is intended. It will not be every single term that is prescribed. It will, for instance, be that you must make sure that Section 6A is taken into account when you enter into this contract. So what are your provisions on Section 6A in this contract? Because the author might not know about the rights in Section 6A and therefore enter into a contract that excludes it. And that is where this protection comes from. And the same goes with contractual terms being unenforceable if they go against the Act. It is simply because some authors are not aware of all the rights that this Act actually affords them, and then they enter into contracts that are exploitative and that excludes some of the rights of the Act. So first off, there's nothing wrong with the prescribed minimum terms. It is simply for protection. It does not affect contractual freedom. There are so many provisions made how you can, you know, structure according to your working process. But the fact is the Act must be complied with. And these minimum terms and conditions that will be prescribed will deal with those rights. So that is just what is happening there. And our office is of the view that that should be, there should not be any problem there. So my last two slides, I just want to talk about litigation as a concern. So there was a concern that the whole bill will be declared invalid, but that is not correct. Unless there are procedural concerns, and I've already pointed out there's no procedural concerns. These bills have been really, really gone the extra mile in every turn, and we've got more than enough proof to show the steps that have been made to show the court that Parliament has really gone the extra mile on this. So if there is a clause found to, or a section found to be unconstitutional, that will simply be taken out of the Act. So it will just be those two sentences or three sentences, whatever, that will be taken out of the Act. And again, I can say that from our office's view, there's no doubt that every clause in this bill or these bills will pass constitutional muster. We've had more than one opinion confirming that it will pass constitutional muster, especially keeping in mind the balance that it's trying to bring between various constitutional rights. But I'm not the constitutional court, and they might find something is unconstitutional, but then only that will be excised. There was one presenter that indicated that in respect of fair dealing, there has only been one court case so far. Now, I'm not sure what she means by that, because I found the law program that Parliament uses, when I searched fair dealing with copyright, I found over 1,000 cases that dealt with fair dealing. And those are only the reported cases. In the Birchall's on IP law, there was 21 cases that were discussed that dealt with fair dealing. So it is not fair to say that the one system will cause more or less litigation than the other. Litigation happens. That's what happens with matters. We have a difference of opinion, and then one way to sort that is to go to the court. So there was also concern that there's not enough guidance given to courts, but that is simply not correct. Section 12A gives four factors that will be considered. There's also each specific exception that has their own guidelines on what can be used. Then there was also a statement at some point that the USA law is not compatible with our law. Now, I'm not sure why that would be the case, why English and common law would be more compatible with South African law, because we no longer are an English or common law country. We are a constitutional country. Our law is based on our constitution. And only insofar as our constitution gives effect to other forms of law does our country recognize it. So yes, common law, insofar as it does not conflict with the Constitution, is acknowledged in our country. That doesn't mean that we're a common law country. And in more than one case, our courts have indicated that they will consider the judgments of other countries, especially where there has been such a rich history as in the USA. So when we look at the USA wording, you'll see that the wording that we have is very, very, very similar. I think that fourth factor, like I said, the department wants to change that a bit. That is the one, the substitution effect, that is where they have a problem. But the wording of the US is the effect on the use on potential market or value of work. And I even found a whole section on the website in the USA where you type in a scenario and it gives you cases that dealt with that scenario. So there's more than enough examples to look at. If a user in South Africa is a bit concerned, I mean, my advice would be go and look at the USA thing, if that website. If you can find your example there, at least you know there's something that you can rely on should something happen. But I would definitely not say that law should not change simply because we're scared of litigation. If that was the case, we probably would not even have adopted our constitution. It brought a very big difference in the South African law. And especially because these bills are giving effect to the constitution, I don't think we should be scared of litigation. Chair, I took much longer than I thought I would take. I do apologize for that, but that is the end of my presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Advocate Fanomeve, for the presentation. Just want to check if Mr. Samara Ali wants to add anything before we hand over to the department.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, honorable members and colleagues. Chair, just one point with regards to the procedural requirements. I do concur with the legal analysis given by Advocate Fanomeve. And I do concur as well, in addition, that the committee has indeed met all procedural requirements thus far in processing the bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Honourable members, let's allow the department to take us through. After that, then we will ask questions for clarities. As I suggest that DDG, Dr. Masuso, maybe you should start on slide 9. The minister has given the opening remarks, touch on the issues that are also on other slides up to slide 8. If you can just take us straight to slide 9 on definitions, but also if you can also touch on the questions of policy that Advocate Fanomeve referred to, but also some other proposals in terms of amendments and also definition. For example, definition on the author, I didn't see it on the slide of the department. If you can also talk to that as well. Over to you, DDG Masoch.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning to honourable members, and good morning to you, Chair. Wishing you more recovery and good health, and a wonderful year ahead as well. Even though it's not New Year, we're done with that part.
Recording in progress.
Okay. All right. Okay, let me stop the video. Okay. So the presentation is going to be very brief. I'll try to keep it very brief and go into the slide that the chair has proposed. I start with, and for the honorable members, we've included the objectives of the bills just to assist with where we are coming from, the purpose of the bill, of the copyright amendment bill, and some of the issues that have transpired before that the Deputy Minister has spoken to. So I will be more brief, but I'll try to cover as much as I can in terms of what has been raised. We went through the submissions, we read them, and we grouped some of the comments. So if there is a comment you see that was made by your entity or by yourself, and but other names are not appearing, it's not because we didn't look at them. Some of them are representative of other comments similar to the ones that are on the screen. And as advocates, I don't prefer to read line by line. However, for the purposes of recognizing the inputs, I'm going to do that in terms of just going through the public comment, reading them. And I took most of them, we took most of them verbatim, just to make sure that they capture the essence of what was raised, but focusing more on the recommendations and the approaches that were recommended. And where we are recommending that there should be changes or proposed changes or a review of a particular provision is because of we are recognizing that these are very important bills, talking to the performance protection as well. These are very important pieces of legislation. And in the spirit of balance and collaboration and working together, there's always scope for improvements, scope for reviewing of decisions of where or where certain positions were before. The policy positions remain mostly similar, but then where we see that we could look at issues, we have endeavored to do so. And I will look at those areas that advocate was indicating, because it doesn't mean what we had before was incorrect, but we recognize that it's important that when we move forward, we take into account the views that have been presented, because we want a legislation that works, that also addresses concerns for the public in general, and to make the process more neutral and balanced, and to make sure that there is that fairness as well. So in terms of the definition that we are starting with, we start with the definition of broadcast. This definition was debated extensively. So among the issues raised, there was a concern that the amendment to the definition of broadcast is vague and could create uncertainty for the creative sector. And also that until the draft white paper process that advocates spoke to has been finalized and the necessary legislative amendments have been effected, the current definition in the Act should be retained. And then there were other experts who were of the view that there is no recognition of the relationship between the definitions of broadcast and that of the program carrying signals. And so here they were talking about